Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Ice Lake is not faster than Comet Lake. RTX 2060 price drops, a new AMD flagship. The rumors are starting, and AMD's 3950X is still a beast. All that and more coming up next on Twitch. This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Using the same password everywhere is a security nightmare waiting to happen. LastPass easily creates unique passwords for every site. Visit LastPass.com/twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 549, recorded on January 16th, 2020. Big Navi and the Ice Lake Fail. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, a Twitch weekly show about, amazingly enough, hardware. We're going to get some hands-on useful information, some speculation, some mayhem, and we're going to talk about everything from phones to consoles to, of course, processors and GPUs. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Sebastian Peake, editor-in-chief PC Per, who is still excited, delighted,
and
amazed by the 16-core 3950X. Is this your favorite processor of 2019 slash early 2020?
It's certainly my favorite processor of 2020 so far, Patrick. I mean, the year, we're well underway. We're 2 weeks in. I can't find a processor to top it, and I've tried fairly hard to do that. But fairly, yeah, I mean, hard. We didn't have hands-on with the 3950X when it first launched, and
right,
it was in short supply. And that, here's the kind of the amazing thing about this. I finally released a review of it because suddenly availability got better. AMD was able to start sending out their second wave of review samples. So we got caught up. We're back up to speed. Benchmarked the 3950X in various situations. And the kind of the amazing thing about this is, for a very small price premium per core over their already very impressive Ryzen 9 3900X, you get, and it's about a $5 premium per core, so not that much, you get a processor that has 16 cores instead of 12, slightly higher single core clocks, and lower base clock. It's kind of this odd trade-off. The 3900X is 12 cores, 24 threads, 3.8 gigahertz, and it can boost up to 4.6 gigahertz. And then the Ryzen 9, you have the full 16 cores, two 8-core chiplets fully enabled, slightly lower overall speed, 3.5 gigahertz, so 300 megahertz slower, which you'd expect when you increase core counts and the density and
you know,
worries about leakage and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it makes sense. But then it can single core boost up to 4.7. And the only way they really could achieve this is through binning. They were kind of cherry picking the chiplets being used so they could clock that slightly higher single core number. And we've talked about this throughout the year, last year, pretty much since this was announced at E3, that the binning process on this could potentially be problematic. And it seemingly was. And now within the last week or two, I'm seeing these show up at their $749 MSRP randomly, like they'll be in stock at a Best Buy or something. And I'm seeing prices on eBay drop all the way down to around $799. So it seems like it's stabilized. 7-nanometer yields must be pretty good because all of a sudden this is around MSRP, which is kind of nuts. And then, I mean, we could talk about the performance. I mean, just imagine, we've talked about it before on the podcast, but we're onto a newer version of the firmware. The AGESA version is different than when this CPU actually launched. I tested it with the latest, so like 1.0.0.4. And I believe it's revision B that we're on right now. But it is going to show you, like, you're going to see higher overall performance easily because you're dealing with something that has 4 more cores, 8 more threads. But just comparing it against the Intel side, I was looking at recent results that I'd run over the last month or two with the Core i9-10980XE, that $1,000 flagship high-end desktop part from Intel. And compared to that, this is still giving you slightly higher performance in certain workloads. Pretty much all of the workloads that I tested had the 3950X on top. And it's a cheaper part. you know, video compression testing that I did. You can argue, you know, whether X264 two pass is the right way to test video anymore. I need to switch over to Handbrake or whatever. But 7-zip compression, it was faster. It was faster in Cinebench. Like all the usual benchmark numbers that people look at, you're seeing a processor, I think because of the core clock, the clock speed advantage was actually beating out the 18-core 10980XE and just across the, like, every CPU benchmark that I ran. And then in the gaming tests, it got kind of ugly for the 10980XE, which is, it consistently delivered the lowest frame rates with the same graphics card. Yeah.
Like, if you want
the 10980XE consistently offered the lowest gaming performance of the little group of tested processors, and I think there's a reason that Intel does not use this in their charts. If they're talking about gaming performance, they're going to be using the 9900K or KS, and I use the KS. I'm like, well, you know, it's around, I think their actual MSRP for that CPU is this unusual $513. So it's very close to a 3900X. Okay, we'll use Intel's best part. And that clock speed advantage does seem to help because that's a 5 gigahertz processor. And so it's faster even than the maximum single core boost of the 3950X. And it was mildly interesting to look this over and see the differences between the two Ryzen 9s. They're so close. I mean, don't buy the 3950X because you think it's going to be giving you better gaming performance, because it's essentially deadlocked with the 3900X. They traded back and forth over which one was faster, because apparently some games were more reliant on the bursty single core performance, and some of them the higher overall all core clock speed of the 3900X was still faster. So but in the end, I was happy to finally get through and benchmark the CPU myself and see how, like, what kind of a value it was. Because I had it in my head that a 3900X was still a better value. And when I actually put together a chart, like, there's a section in my review that's on pricing, and there's a little price per core. And it's based on launch price. So
right,
we're finally to the point where the 3950X is basically at its launch price. And it's only, like I said, it's only $5 more. It's like $5.23 more per core to get the 16-core version. It's still a better value to get the 3900X technically. It is $41.58 per core, and the Ryzen 9 3950X is $46.81 per core if you buy it at MSRP. And then Intel's processor is next on the list at $54.39 per core. And that's if you can find it, A, and find it at the MSRP. So all of this is there's a lot of assumptions being made. But it's impressive to see how on the CPU side of things, like CPU benchmarks, CPU intensive tasks, and on the gaming side, Ryzen 9 is faster than Intel's Core i9 high-end desktop part. And it's not always especially close. And you're also getting something that's $10, $12 less per core. And it's just really, obviously, this has been beaten endlessly to death, but the Zen 2 architecture is really, really good. And I am feeling more and more positive about their 7-nanometer availability, the future of these high-end Ryzen 9 parts becoming more mainstream, when they felt like these sort of exotic, hard-to-buy processors for a long time over the last 6 months.
But they weren't necessarily exotic and hard to buy. They were impossible to buy, which made them seem much more exotic than they actually are. Let's be honest. It was impossible to find one. I mean, it also amazes me, like, looking at some of the reported wattage consumption between the 3900 and the 3950, or 3900X and the 3950X.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we're seeing like 150-ish watts, which is way over the 105-watt TDP that they were talking about. In real world, and then, which actually, and I'm seeing numbers for the 3900, some people are reporting consumption up in the neighborhood of 200 watts, which is so 9 years ago, I don't have words for it, but at least you are getting a tremendous amount of performance for that. So
yeah, And part of that binning process that gave you the higher clocks is lower power consumption with the 3950X, which is crazy. It's the same architecture, and you go from the 12-core version to the 16-core version. And the 16-core version, with all 16 cores running at 100%, consumes less power. So
that makes no sense. Like 25% less power. You know.
Yeah, at times. It depends. Yeah, and obviously there's probably a better sample of a 3900X out there versus another one. And you could do your own binning. But yeah, the processors that were released by AMD to be the 16-core version have already been cherry-picked, and they already have lower power consumption. So that's something to consider if you're a little worried about that. Because the TDP, it's sort of your nominal number. It will nominally require 105 watts. It's going to be more than that under load, sure. And we've seen that on the Intel side where the 9900K, that's easily your 150-plus watt processor under load. And that's an 8-core processor. So these still are very competitive as far as power consumption goes compared to what Skylake-based 14-nanometer stuff on Intel's side is. So until we see Intel come down to the lower process nodes, I think AMD will have the advantage in power consumption.
From the completely useless but still interesting department, falling memory prices and demand mean that as of 2019, Intel is once again the world's largest semiconductor manufacturer. Samsung, of course, took that spot back in 2017. Samsung, since having some issues and have shut down a considerable amount of their semiconductor manufacturing. You know, the other thing that's interesting is looking at so what you see right now is an article from Tom's Hardware, which is written up by Arne Verheide. And one of the big things, takeaways from that article, was that semiconductor revenue was down something like 12%. That's according to Gartner's analysis of the 2019 global semiconductor market, driven by the downturn in the memory markets. And I'm going to end a quote on that since I pretty much started a direct quote from the article on Tom's Hardware. But the it's kind of crazy. You know, RAM prices are down, you know, Intel's memory business is a tiny portion of its overall revenue. So if you care about these things, it's something to care about. It's also kind of crazy to look once you get past, you know, Intel 65,793,000 in 2019 revenue. That's like 15.7% of the market. And, Samsung's like 52 and 12.5% of the market. Then you drop way down to 22,478, and that's SK Hynix, which is 5.4% of the market. Then Micron, Broadcom, Qualcomm. I thought it was interesting that Qualcomm's numbers were so small, but then you realize that maybe they're just not charging as much for their individual processors compared to, say, Intel. And, of course, Samsung was doing ridiculous volumes of memory. Interesting article up on the Nantech. This – I don't know if you caught this one, Sebastian. Dr. Ian Cutress, the title of this article is Intel's Confusing Messaging is Comet Lake Better Than Ice Lake. And
oh, hey, look at that guy. You see that? You see that guy hiding in the bottom left corner of this image?
Is that who I think that is?
He looks familiar to me. And anyone else watching this? Look at him. Look at that attractive redheaded man.
Talking benchmarks.
That's right.
Well, it's interesting, right? Oh, goodness. So there's a lot of stuff going on with Intel, right? Project Athena, which is sort of the next generation of ultra-portable laptop. Tiger Lake, which looks like it's going to succeed. Ice Lake later this year. And what Dr. Cutress noticed is it was a R7 3750H with an RTX 2060 against a Core i7-9750H, same GPU, same speed. Then sort of Intel's like, we're ahead in the gaming tests. But I'm going to quote Dr. Cutress here. This isn't the slide I want to talk about today. There were a pair of slides Intel showed that had me rather confused and surprised that I don't think anyone else picked up on. And there was two sets of data for 15-watt processors, right? The Ryzen 7 3700U against Intel's Comet Lake Core i7 1071U, and then AMD's Ryzen 7 3700U against Intel's Ice Lake-based Core i7 1065G7. And what Dr. Cutress did was to pull together – well, I'll just quote Dr. Cutress again. From Intel's data, I wanted to put Comet versus Ice onto one graph. With the data in one graph, we can see why Intel's own slides did not put the data together. Ice Lake loses in most benchmarks against Comet Lake.
This should not be surprising, by the way, to anyone who follows this industry. Because if you're not familiar, Ice Lake is Intel's first 10-nanometer mobile architecture. And Comet Lake was the 10th-gen mobile architecture released last year, and we talked about it here, where they were looking for those higher core count, higher frequency, more powerful mobile processors for things like mobile workstations, and it's what ended up in the new MacBook Pro. And those right. were, again, on the 14-plus Skylake derivative. It was like the fourth revision to Skylake architecture we've seen so far. And right. they had to round out their product portfolio with the 10th generation by going back to 14-nanometer. And it's not surprising to see that they would not choose internally to pit 10-nanometer against 14-nanometer 10th gen, because you're not going to lose when you have higher core count and greater clock speed. So Comet Lake wins pretty much across the board for CPU.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ice Lake, of course, twice as fast on GPU results.
Yes.
But, you know, just something worth noting if you're thinking about spending a lot of money for a laptop you're going to be sitting on for the next 2 or 3 years. You might want to wonder, you just take a moment, contemplate, do you need the GPU performance, or should you maybe wait for more core performance, or should you spend less money for an older processor? I love it when choosing processors becomes this much easier. That's sarcasm, by the way.
We didn't have a complex enough product stack to try to sift through in 2019. So let's make sure it's as clear as that mud much, again.
Let's make sure the simplest choices we generally make, which is the new mobile parts, are invariably better performing for workloads than the previous generation parts. And let's just make them the same, unless you're looking for graphics performance. I don't even know where to go with that. WCCF yeah. Tech has an interesting and highly speculative article talking about the, quote, mysterious AMD Radeon RX 5950 XT flagship GPU spotted in EEC registration. Is this big Navi? Or I should say Navi.
I don't know. I mean, this is, like you said, speculative. There are some Twitter accounts that seem to invariably end up as the source for articles like this. And Kamachi is right. one of the most sourced. Tom Apisak and Kamachi are the two that I'm most familiar with. And, you know, EEC filings, that seems significant. And it's interesting when somebody drills down and finds the information that's already out there publicly available. But you would think if they were close to RX 5950 XT that we would see something about it at CES. But hey, maybe they're planning a separate announcement. Last year, if you remember CES, they announced Radeon 7, and it was available less than a month later, or just about 1 month later. I think it was released on February 7th. So it was quick. Like, the turnaround was quick. I got back from CES, and I had, like, right away, I had a package with the review unit getting ready to benchmark. So I would be shocked if we got this quickly. I mean, they did announce a Navi GPU at CES. If you remember, they announced the RX 5600 XT, which is basically a lower memory, slower variant of the RX 5700. So it'll be less expensive. They announced it at $279. But we've been waiting for big Navi for a long time. We've been waiting for big Navi since before the first Navi GPUs were even announced, because we had the roadmap. We'd seen the roadmap back when Raja was still at AMD, and they had sort of pinpointed Navi. That's when AMD catches up to NVIDIA. Like, that's when, I mean, that was kind of the talk. It's I don't think AMD ever came out and said, we're going to beat NVIDIA by the time we reach the Navi architecture. But I think that's been kind of assumed that depending on how the architecture scales, and that's one of those terms, scaling, we talk about that. And if you're not familiar with the concept, at least from the GPU side of things, one of the issues with the previous architecture that AMD was using, which is Graphics Core Next, which they used for years and years and is still available on a lot of their products, any of the Vega products and the Polaris products like the RX 4 and 500 series, it had a limit. It was capped. You could not go above 64 compute units. So you could never go above a certain number of cores, 4,096. And there were other limitations with the architecture. And we're on to a new architecture now, RDNA, which AMD has been very public about, or at least to media, has been very upfront about being a new architecture. This is brand new. We built this from the ground up. And even though from a topological look, you see a lot of similarities between RDNA and Graphics Core Next, or GCN. Mm-hmm. They said that it's all new. We don't know, however. It may or may not have the very same 64 CU limit. That may not be as important to their competitiveness as it was, because they're getting so much higher performance with the same or even fewer cores than Vega graphics cards were. I mean, we've seen the RX 5700 XT come within about 5% of the Radeon 7. And there was a reason that product was discontinued. The Radeon 7 was end of life after just a few months, because Navi came out and Navi was so good that even with far fewer streaming processors, like 2560 versus 4096, you had a product that could come very close to outperforming it. And we've been waiting for that big Navi that's at least 64 compute units again, and see what it can do versus the likes of the RTX 2080 Ti. And if this is a real product, if RX 5950 XT is real, you'd think with that naming convention, that would be a flagship level part. We've seen products from AMD in the maybe multi GPU isn't viable anymore, because products like the RX, was it the RX 295 X2? That was their last huge multi GPU flagship level part. Back when the RX 290. I'm thinking of the 290, the R9 290. There was an R9 295 X2 that was their just no holds barred, liquid cooled monstrosity. I don't think they're going down that road anymore. But for a single GPU part, you'd think they'd at least have to match the 64 CUs of the Radeon 6 or like the Vega 64. But we'll see. We'll see if, and I really hope we don't. I don't have word from AMD about the actual practical limits of Navi. I think there have been some assumptions made that it's actually more similar to GCN than they would let on, and that we would have to then wait until the next new architecture to burst through that 4096 streaming processor limit, and then see something that could just completely destroy NVIDIA. But you know, but it's cat and mouse. It's every time AMD announces something, it seems like NVIDIA has some sort of a response, which I think we'll talk about here shortly.
Speaking of which, let's talk about the. I'm just going to read the title from your article on PC Perspective. EVGA announces the GeForce RTX 2060 RX. Well. EVGA announces the GeForce RTX 2060 KO RX 5600 XT knockout at $279, which is kind of a long title, but
yeah,
probably delightful for search engine optimization.
It has some power words, Patrick. You know how important power words are when you're trying to optimize for SEO.
You don't this say.
I call this their preemptive strike. It's funny. This is not my hyperbole here. The actual quote from EVGA's marketing on this, on their web page for this product, was, quote, "The new EVGA GeForce RTX 2060 KO is here. to knock out, that was in all caps, the competition at a value you cannot pass up, end quote. So clearly, even though they don't name the competition here, this is a response to the RX 5600 XT, which was announced at $279. And so NVIDIA has sort of quietly reduced the price of the RTX 2060 down to $299 from $349. So now it's within $20 of this new AMD part. But then, on top of that, longtime NVIDIA partner EVGA has this product that they're selling right now for $279. This is just kind of a limited time,
right?
Like $20 instant rebate offer on their website. But I've seen at like. There were a couple of things that hit me about this. First of all, you know, of course, NVIDIA always had that option of lowering the price a little bit to make something like the RTX 2060 more appealing. And AMD doesn't really have an answer for that with this product. They could drop the price of the RX 5700, but then they'd have to drop the price of this new 5600 XT as well. And so it becomes kind of an awkward situation for AMD as far as pricing goes, because $279.99, somewhere in there, that's about as much as AMD could possibly justify charging for this new product. And that's
right.
That sounds biased, I guess. If you think that I'm a pro NVIDIA, you could point to that, because I've been saying since June that AMD seems to charge as much as they think they can reasonably justify, whereas NVIDIA can say, let's drop the price. Like when they came out with the super cards, those were essentially price drops, although there were different configurations. You got what was essentially an RTX 2070 for the price of a 2060 and so on. But it's pretty powerful to say, you know, hey, you know that product that AMD showed on stage at CES and every one of their charts had it pitted against a GTX 1660 Ti? At $279. Well, what if we take the RTX 2060, which is considerably more powerful than a 1660 Ti, and sell that for $279? They have no answer for that. So I would expect to see the newly announced Radeon 5600 XT drop down to $259. But then this is a temporary price drop, so maybe they won't. They should, I think. AMD should, to be more competitive, drop the price a little bit. But we will see. One thing that's kind of interesting through this whole process has been the existence of the 1660 Ti, which, Patrick, I know that we talked about this when the 1660 Super launched. Why would anyone buy a 1660 Ti at $279 when you come within about 5% of the performance with the 1660 Super? For $50 less, that's a $229 and up graphics card that comes very close to the performance of the 279 and up graphics card. So close, in fact, that it's like it's negligible. It's what's two or three frames per second in a game if you're already over 60, if you're already over whatever your monitor's refresh rate is.
Well, it depends how desperate your marketing department is.
Yeah. and we've talked about the segmentation to death, and it's
right.
We've reached the point where there are I would have thought they'd discontinue the 1660 Ti because the Super kind of replaces it, and really at that point, why even have the Super? Just price cut the 1660 Ti. But
I think they're leaving everything in the inventory. Everything that's in the channel is just going to stay there until it's sold, or it becomes so embarrassingly outdated for the price versus the performance that they just have to give up and either slash the prices. They just seem to be sitting on everything at this point. It's painful. It's irritating. Yeah.
Although I will say, maybe it was the brilliant long play strategy. Like they were playing chess when I was mentally playing checkers or something. When the 1660, what am I trying to say? When the RTX 2060 Super came out, I was confused as to why they were still selling the non-super version of that card. They discontinued the they discontinued the RTX 2070, replaced it with a Super. They discontinued the RTX 2080, replaced it with a Super. They left the RTX 2060 in place at $349 and released the Super at $399. And now they have cut the RTX 2060 down to $299, which makes sense. That's what it should have been cut down to begin with.
Sure.
So there's that bridge between the GTX and the RTX series at $299 before you jump up to $399 with the 2060 Super. If anything I just said is even reasonably accurate, I guess in the end it made sense to keep the RTX 2060 alive and not discontinue it. But the continued existence of the 1660 Ti is puzzling. It's troubling.
Yeah.
And I don't like it.
You've spent way too much time thinking through this. That's all I'm going to say.
Extreme of consciousness, Patrick. I'm not even thinking.
You're thinking.
Tell, if you carefully listen to the words that I'm saying, there's not a whole lot of, I'm not going to say validity, but maybe sanity behind a lot of it.
There's some measurable percentage of the clock cycles available inside of your skull that are dedicated to being pissed off about the 1660 Ti, period. End of discussion. There's no arguing that. You want that card to die.
I won't even try to argue with it.
Hey, let's switch. Before we talk about 1080p gaming and why it apparently is still incredibly critical, because apparently everybody still loves 1080p gaming, we want to remind you that we are happy you're tuning into our podcast. We hope you subscribed. If you subscribe, we're delighted. We don't care if it's the audio or the video. We're just happy you're here and joining us each and every week. And here at the Twit Network, we might have the best security podcast ever, certainly the most approachable. If you haven't checked it out, Security Now, Steve Gibson, Leo Laporte cover every major hack, virus, vulnerability, and bug out there. Steve knows what he's talking about. He coined the term spyware, created the first anti-spyware program, plus SpinRite, Shields Up, and Squirrel, which I like saying. That's S-Q-R-L, if you don't like acronyms, or acronyms pronounced as words. We record the show every Tuesday, or I should say Steve and Leo record the show every Tuesday. So stay up to date on all things internet security and subscribe to Security Now on your favorite podcatcher, or you can head over to twit.tv/SN and find all of the information, all the older shows, the video, the audio, or hey, like I said, just search for Security Now on your favorite podcatching tool. Part of the Twit Network that we are part of, and we invite you to go check out Security Now if you haven't done so. So I mentioned a second ago 1080p gaming. WCCF Tech, in partnership with AI and John Petty Research, got together and they polled. They got like 4,500 responses to 26 questions they put out in October of 2019. And I should say instead of AI, it's Antikythera Intelligence and Research. Where they were looking at the PC gamers and the WCCF Tech audience and, you know, taking a look at what people are buying and what they're looking for and what they own. And shockingly, as we've seen oh so many years from a certain online video gaming, video sales and streaming platform, well, technically not streaming, I guess, downloading platform. You know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about. That 1080p is still the most popular standard for gaming. But it was also interesting because at least for the WCCF Tech audience, AMD, quote, reigns supreme and VR is making a comeback. And most of these responses were from the US and the UK. And but it was interesting. And again, this is a subset of enthusiastic gamers on an enthusiast site, but they found like 41% of the respondents had AMD processors. They were looking to purchase NVIDIA's newest graphics boards or, you know, cards. That they actually seem to be kind of excited about VR. So I just thought it was interesting that despite the fact that it was an enthusiast site, people still mostly game at 1080p.
Yeah.
I might even be a little disappointed by that, but it is what it is. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, if you look at Steam hardware survey results, and those are out there for anybody to check, and it's kind of amazing because it's not even close. There's something like 80% or more of people the last time I looked on 1080p. And then there are these tiny, like 2-4% of people on like the high resolution monitors, like 1440 and above. I think it's like 4%.
Right.
4K was at like, I think, 1.5% the last time I looked. It's not – and then there's the sort of unusual non-traditional, I should say, resolutions for the ultra-wide monitors. So you have something like 2560 by 1080 or, you know, 3820 right. by 1440 or something. So it's not surprising, I guess, that if you're talking mainstream, if you were to go into a big box store that sells monitors – or you go into Costco and you look at the monitors. Monitors up to 27 inches are being sold relatively inexpensively now, but they're 1080p.
Right.
And if you want high resolution, like 2560 by 1440, that has a premium attached to it. So if somebody's comparing, like, let's see, I'm going to game on this. Are you spending the extra money for the higher resolution, which then also would require you to have a more powerful graphics card to be able to push all those extra pixels because it's not insignificant. WQHD. 2560 by 1440 is four times the pixels of, you know, 720p HD video.
Right.
So
I just noticed this because I was digging into the steam powered charts, and let me post that up so Kevin can try to drop that in. This is so. I don't know if you've ever dug into this, but it's something I never realized before. They do, or maybe they've added it recently. So if you go into the primary display resolution, right, you scroll down, you know, it's like December 19 items, Windows, Mac, and Linux, and you can drop down to filter kind of the results for all of the data. And, yeah, the primary display resolution is 1080p. Scroll down and then just sort of click where it says primary display resolution. I'm now narrating for the folks on audio if you're not watching the video. And right, so 69.27%, up 4.64%, is 1920 by 1080. The next largest block of screen real estate is 1366 by 768. That's 8.6% of the user base. And shockingly, and I am actually utterly delighted by this, 2560 by 1440 is now almost 7% of the user base. So apparently it was a very good Christmas for a lot of people, maybe. That's up 1.25%. What I didn't realize, and it makes these numbers make maybe a little bit more sense, is simplified Chinese is now like the largest percentage of language on Steam. English is 30.43%. Russian is 9.36%. Spanish is 3.59%. Simplified Chinese is 37.87%, which makes me realize if you think about kind of where the – you know, it's – I never realized that it was that huge of a chunk of people coming from China on Steam. So that might explain why 1080p is stayed as a standard. Also because – for so long, it was just so expensive to move to anything larger than 1080p in terms of the cost of the monitor and, of course, the fact that you would have to deal with a considerably more powerful GPU to get any kind of gaming performance on that one.
Yeah.
That was fascinating. I'm impressed. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, it's fine. I'm impressed by that, but also seeing that since the last time I looked at this, 1080p has dropped about 10%. It's been a year or so, but it was at about 80%. So to see it just south of 70% now, and to see WQHD creeping up to nearly 7% makes me happy. Because I feel like enthusiasts who are not, you know, it's not the mainstream market at large. If you're talking about PC hardware enthusiasts, these are people who, like us, we like processors and graphics cards and the new architectures that come out. And we're excited about building a new system or upgrading our system with the newest part. And if you're doing all of that just to play at 1080p, it seems kind of anticlimactic. Because, like, yeah, my graphics card, like, it's 144 frames per second on my 60 hertz 1920 by 1080 monitor. So you'd think that part and parcel with being an enthusiast is probably having a display with a much higher resolution. Because that's part of being an enthusiast is, you know, you buy the 4K monitor when you're an early adopter and pay way too much money for it. And then you start using that to justify all of your hardware purchases to hit those, you know, the acceptable frame rates on your new high resolution monitor. So, I mean, I feel like that's a more likely scenario than I bought a $2,000 gaming PC and play it at 1080p. But hey, that happens too. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think we're missing some of the picture with Steam hardware surveys. And I know that I think AMD's contention, because if you look at the GPU side, it's like NVIDIA, 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 Intel, NVIDIA, Intel. And then AMD is somewhere in just out of the top 10, or maybe they're sneaking into the top 10 by now. But they apparently internet cafes, like gaming cafes, and this would be probably in China, judging by the huge majority there in the results. It's apparently every time you log into one of these systems, it's creating a new entry for a new user in the Steam hardware results survey. So that would also explain why Simplified Chinese has 37% of all Steam use. Well, every time you sign into one of those internet cafe machines, it's creating a new entry with a new Intel processor, a new NVIDIA graphics card, and a new Simplified Chinese user. So that's the conspiracy side of it. Talk to one of AMD's marketing people sometime at a party, and you could probably steer the conversation this direction. So there's probably some validity to that that they've been rather bitter about. But it's still, I mean, whether the numbers are inflated or not, I think one of the other takeaways from this is that there's a lot of people on laptops. That 1366 by 768, I'm guessing that has to do with laptop gaming, I would hope anyway. And plus all the people on Intel graphics. I don't think you're building a PC to play games and then using the integrated Intel graphics. At least I hope you're not. Even an old used GPU at that point, and you'd have better performance. But
just get a set of crayons and some sheets of paper. In any case, speaking of entry level and low cost gaming, this is a little aged now, but I want to remind people of something that Gamers Nexus did a few years ago. The thing I'm thinking about is single versus dual channel memory, i.e. using one versus two sticks of memory in a PC. They did a sub $500 gaming PC build for Cyber Monday, and part of what they looked at is the 560 versus the 1050, but they also looked at single versus dual channel performance. And I want to remind people that memory benchmarks make dual channel memory look really impressive. Actual, other benchmarks maybe don't look nearly as impressive, but if you look at their sort of sub 500 PC build, the results between two 4 gigabyte sticks and one 8 gigabyte stick are virtually, if 3/10 of a frame is a big deal for you, then you might want to go for 2 4-gigabyte sticks over 1 8-gigabyte stick. But it's, if you're looking to upgrade to 16 gigabytes in the future, it's much nicer to have a single 8-gig stick now. Sometimes there's pricing advantages. But I just want to, kind of reiterate, real-world performance on single versus dual-channel memory is just about nil. Well, 6/10 of a frame on Doom benchmarks.
But, Patrick, when you run the Ada 64 Extreme benchmarks, for memory latency and speed, it looks so much more impressive when you're in dual channel memory.
It does. But we're more about real world. We are. And also, if you missed the show last week, go listen to it and learn about the AMD Ryzen 5 1600 AF, which is not the AMD Ryzen 5 you're thinking of. It's a whole new $100 part. And if you're looking for $100, you got $100 for CPU. This is the part to beat, the updated version of the AMD Ryzen 5. Yeah.
And I will just add, not even 100 necessarily. I was seeing it for 85. So at $85, awesome. Just buy one. I mean, it's because listen to last week's episode for sure. But in one sentence, the 1600 AF is actually a 2600.
Dun, dun, dun.
Spoiler.
Oh, my goodness. It's not just CES, it's changing. PlayStation, quote, will not participate in E3 2020. The company will instead attend hundreds of consumers' events across the globe. That's what Sony told GameIndustry.biz. And this is, this is something we've seen in a lot of industries and a lot of places where they go from big, massive things. Remember Comdex? If you're old enough, you might remember Comdex. Or CES, they find that CES no longer serves their needs or is too expensive to, or they're just lost. Because the event is so big, or the timing of the event, that early January thing that CES is, maybe the beginning of the year is a bad time to announce new products. PlayStation skipping E3 for the second year in a row, which makes me wonder if they are done with E3 as an event permanently.
I wouldn't be surprised. This feels like when Apple stopped going to CES, because we have our own platform. We'll just send out media invites and have our own press events whenever we want to. And you learn about it about a week in advance. So
isn't that
they
convenient?
Can start doing that. Yeah. I mean, it's so, better for them. But, it, I mean, absolutely. Nintendo has their directs. I would say, Nintendo's still at E3, though, I think. But
I think.
Nintendo announces things through their own channels, just like Apple and, you know, just like Sony, just like Microsoft.
Right.
What Microsoft calls their events. So it's probably a bigger deal. Plus, the coverage is going to be the same either way. Whenever they want to have their announcements, it's going to have media coverage. They're going to invite all the important, you know, video game media people to be at the event.
Right.
And social media helps to spread the word. And it's I guess a larger question, Patrick, would be, are trade shows dying? Are they as necessary anymore?
Based on what I saw at CES this year, no. But they are changing. And part of what's interesting about this games industry, that biz article that Christopher Dring put together, is they point out that, you know, the ESA, which organizes the E3, that, you know, there's kind of a split here, right? Because E3 has been where Sony's been a part of E3 since 1995. It was a huge part of their build up to the PlayStation 4. It's where, it's funny, like the original PlayStation is kind of, you know, released in lockstep with E3 in 1995. It's been a big deal. There's been a tight relationship there. But there's a lot of there's kind of a struggle in the ECSA to define what E3 is going to be, whether it's going to be like, oh, well, you know, that Penny Arcade thing where they do a lot of video games and it's fun, you know, for the users, versus it's an industry event that's for the industry. And that's kind of, I think, been a real nasty battle inside of the ESA. I also thought it was funny that, you know, there was a response to this article from an ESA spokesperson, which was just pure PR speak. Quote, E3 is a signature event celebrating the video game industry and showcasing the people, brands, and innovations redefining entertainment loved by billions of people around the world. E3 2020 will be an exciting high-energy show featuring new experiences, partners, exhibitor spaces, activations, and programming that will entertain new and veteran attendees alike. Exhibitor interests or new activations is gaining the attention of brands that view E3 as a key opportunity to connect with the video game fans worldwide. You know, so
and,
this
you
is
know,
kind
if you've
of
been
classic.
Having trouble sleeping, read through some of this. Slog
read through
some
any
of this
collection
PR-speak.
Of press releases. But I yep. mean, this is also, you could say, well, okay, so CES lost Microsoft, or CES lost Google, or CES lost, you know, whoever CES lost, but they replaced it with other things like fake meat and airlines. So, you know, I don't know. It's one of the things that somebody pointed out to me is that CES has to pay for these venues that they've secured, and that CES has gone again. I said it last week. It's gone from sort of like, hey, we're about, you know, televisions and stereos, to we're about computers and gaming and lots of other stuff, and now we're about, well, whatever they're about. I think mostly this is about decoupling their release schedule from E3 and being able to drop the events they want, when they want, how they want, and controlling that. The other thing I thought was a great read this week, Polygon has an article on where the Kinect came from, which I had no idea that the sort of the technology at the core of the Kinect came from five, quote, unemployed IDF soldiers. These guys had finished their enlistment in Israel, and they, you know, they were scientists, they were engineers. They quote, wanted to make technology disappear. And, you know, they did a demo. Microsoft freaked out. And you know, basically decided to take their – they take this initial technology they created, and it evolved into the Kinect, which seemed so amazing for so long until, basically the article explains why, quote, all the money in the world couldn't make Kinect happen. And a big part of that was the difficulty getting developers on board, and the difficulty of writing to it, and how it just, you know, what a challenge it was. And I also never realized how much of it was a response, you know, or how much the Wii kind of figured into Intel's relationship to the Kinect. Good read over at Polygon.
Someday we will all revisit the Nintendo Wii and just kind of be amazed Because it's become this thing, not to go too off topic, but it's become this thing that I was in retail when the Wii was first sold, and it was so incredibly hard to find for the first few months, and everybody was buying them as soon as they came into stock, and we could never keep them in stock. And then it slowly evolved into this thing that everybody I knew and their parents literally had one, and they started just becoming this sort of closet fodder where, I've got a Wii somewhere. I don't know where it is. It's in a box. And I think that's kind of still the case. You can find them fairly, like really, actually, cheaply on eBay. They only sort of made a comeback in the last year or two because it became more mainstream to exploit the whatever that last version of the operating system was. It's very easy to put homebrew software on it, and inevitably that will lead to certain illicit practices that put the entire NES, SNES, Genesis, and GameCube libraries on one device. But other than that, it's no longer relevant. But then Kinect came and went, and motion controls are still alive within the VR world. But just think about a time when it was like 13 years ago, 14 years ago almost, when people were literally dancing around and waving their arms in their living room at their TV to play games. And here we are, back to sort of slouching back on the couch with a wireless controller just playing games again. So,
again.
Yeah. I'll have to read over this article. The Kinect was always puzzling to me. I felt it, as a retail person in like electronics and video games, that it was sort of a Me Too product from Microsoft, because it's like, well, of course, Nintendo has their motion sensing, so here's Microsoft with theirs. And of course, PlayStation had theirs, which looked like kind of like an ice cream cone. It was like this controller with like a pool cue on top of it, sort of. You remember that?
Yes.
But yeah, there it is. Yeah, it's like a magic wand, sort of. I won't draw any comparisons to a personal massage tool. You can imagine that for yourself, but.
Oh goodness! No, there was there was one game on that. Gosh,
I think there were several, Patrick. Actually, in the
pantheon
of Sony motion games. What was it? Sony Move, I think it's called.
No,
it was the PlayStation Move.
Oh, PlayStation Move. That's right. Okay. And you can use the PlayStation Move controllers with your PlayStation VR headset, I think.
Oh man, this is going to drive me nuts. There was a game on that called like Amadeus something, but it was a weird mixture of sort of tag and holding the wand, and it was so good.
Well, I mean, it only does everything, Patrick, according to their advertising at the time. Yeah, I love this. If you're watching the video, who wouldn't want to stand in their living room with two of these controllers in their hands and simulate
the
motion of pulling a arrow from what is the thing on the on your back? Is it the quill of arrows? And you have to know exactly where the quiver. Okay, thank you. The quiver, you have to reach back to where the quiver would be, wherever that is. And if you've never had a quiver of arrows on your back, that might be a little bit awkward for you. Or have like a PGA level swing. Like you need to have like your golf swing needs to have like a really good plane. Like you need to be really close to that 45 degree angle on the back swing, and the timing needs to be good. You need 115 mile per hour moment of inertia when you make contact with the ball. And it's just, I wonder why this didn't pan out long term. I guess they were asking people to be too skilled. Like, actually, you need to be a ninja to be able to beat the other ninjas in this game.
That's a really interesting question. Oh my goodness. Johann Sebastian Joust. It was part of Sports Friends.
That's nice. Was it based on the old Joust arcade game?
Nah.
Or was it really like actual... what am I thinking of? Isn't jousting where two people approach each other with
long sticks?
Like on horseback? Or am I, am I wrong yet again?
No, you're not wrong. There's a new version of it called. Oh my goodness! There's a new version called Joust Mania. This is exciting. The handheld light bulb could be really fun if used properly. I'm just excited that I had been thinking about that. And there's another one, Joust Mania. This is exciting. Sebastian, yeah. I'm going to take the house. I'm going to drive to Michigan, and we're going to find Move controllers somewhere, and we will joust. And our wives will just stare and contemplate why they may have made terrible choices in breeding partners. Oh, my goodness.
And I will say, I will clarify for anybody who's too young to remember this, but Johann Sebastian Bach was a composer. He's actually the person I was named after, and not Sebastian Bach from Skid Row. I was not named after the Skid Row Sebastian Bach, just to clear that up, because he was not prominent until like late 80s. So I was born in the early 80s. So I was first, and he stole my thunder.
Oh, my goodness. Now you've got me thinking about Yo-Yo Ma and Chris Teeley and the Goat Rodeo Sessions, because they also did a bunch of Bach stuff. We were talking about technology as much. If you've never heard the Goat Rodeo Sessions, they're amazing if you like classical music. So remember Huawei and the security risks? Financial Times reports, quote, senior U.S. officials have presented Boris Johnson's government with a new dossier of intelligence challenging the U.K.'s claim that it would be able to mitigate the risk of adopting Huawei technology into its 5G network. The officials say it would be nothing short of madness to go ahead. Sources have released, of course, no specifics released. There's just no specific information on this release to the public. But American officials are trying to convince the UK that they're, well, just put Huawei stuff at the edges, not at the core, is a bad idea. So I thought we were pretty much done with all of that. But apparently the U.S. wants to keep the Five Eyes countries out of, or keep Huawei networking out of their 5G networks. So
the U.S. is concerned.
To see that pop up again.
U.S. is obviously concerned that Huawei might put some sort of backdoor into that equipment, which is something they're opposed to, unless it's theirs. So
yeah,
can't our backdoors just coexist? I mean, come on, we all live
can't
on one
we all
planet.
Just get along?
Let's all just spy on everybody all the time together.
Oh goodness. I don't know what to say. I just don't know what to say. I should, however, point out that the Goat Rodeo Sessions are not actually Bach. I take that back.
This?
The Gamba Sonata.
I now I have to look it up. No, is that really a CD? Goat Rodeo Sessions?
The Goat Rodeo Sessions. It's not just a CD. It's a CD
with
Yo-Yo Ma, Stuart Duncan, Edgar Meyer, and Chris Teeley. Some of the best musicians on the planet.
I never thought I'd be typing what I'm typing right now. Yo-Yo Ma, Goat. It's never
rodeo.
A good thing to add a person's
don't
name in the
rodeo.
Word goat in a search, just so you know. I have safe search enabled. This is fine. Here we go. The Goat Rodeo Sessions. It's real. 2011 collaborative album by Yo-Yo Ma, Stuart Duncan, Edgar Meyer, and Chris Thiel.
It's wonderful. It's really good. It's just good stuff. It's good stuff.
It's probably good. I mean, I'm not sure about – is that a mandolin that I'm seeing there?
Yeah, it's Chris Thiele.
Okay.
He got a MacArthur Genius Grant. You'll like him. If you don't, that's okay too. Oh my goodness. One last thing before we go. Maybe two last things before we go. One, Oculus Go is now $150, period. It's a permanent price reduction.
That is cheap.
Suggesting that perhaps – yeah, it was weird. The Oculus Go came out. It was going to be the incredibly inexpensive way to do VR on the Oculus platform, except, of course, it was only 3 degrees of freedom, not 6, which I found incredibly frustrating. And then Oculus sort of rebranded it as the way to consume entertainment. And I will say watching movies on an Oculus Go, if you can get over the fact that you have a giant thing strapped to your face, the surrounds, and you can keep the surround sound coming off the speaker, or I should say that it's not so much surround sound, but it basically creates a bubble of sound around you, which can really irritate the snot out of your spouse. It's actually not a bad way to watch movies Without irritating the rest of your family, or if you're in a small space, or if you're traveling in a hotel. But that's down to 150. The other thing that came up was I didn't realize that Fitbit had been putting blood oxygen monitoring or SpO2 hardware into their devices, quote, for quite some time. Not quote for quite some time, but, you know, for a while. But John Fingus has a nice article up on Engadget where they've been enabling this hardware, this blood oxygen monitoring hardware, on some of their devices, the Versa, the Ionic, and the Charge 3 are, quote, suddenly, if sometimes temporarily, providing blood oxygen data to help track health issues like asthma, heart disease, and sleep apnea. They can't figure out why or where or who's getting it, but it's not device type. It doesn't require premium membership. And Fitbit did confirm that rollout to Engadget. So it's interesting.
I'm just fascinated by the fact they can do that with just sensors. Like, there's a red and infrared sensors to determine the blood oxygen level. I guess that's better than if you put on your smartwatch and this needle came out and just like stabbed you and started drawing your blood.
Right. Well, it's, you know, one of the things that Engadget also points out is Withings. This is not the only company that does this. Withings ScanWatch. It's kind of built around blood oxygen tracking. I'm kind of curious, right? Because Google bought Fitbit. I'm kind of curious to see where it might evolve to. They're using red and infrared sensors to look at oxygen variation. But
so Google bought Fitbit, and now Fitbit knows how much oxygen you have in your blood.
And is telling...
So now, that means Google knows how much oxygen I have in my blood.
The question is will you now start seeing like ads for sleep apnea machines or oxygen tanks?
Yeah. Think about it preemptively. We have looked through your entire purchase history on the internet since its inception and noticed that you've never purchased a CPAP machine and you have sleep apnea, according to the latest data we have from your wrist. So use this coupon code to save 20% on a sleep apnea a CPAP machine.
Why when you can support Google AdSense and a retailer?
Think here for more information directly into your brain.
I don't know what to tell you. Hey, I've got an email from Chips and he says, I wouldn't be too dismissive of Patrick's pal. By the way, if you haven't emailed us, Twitch, twitch@twit.tv is the email address. Chips writes, I wouldn't be too dismissive of Patrick's pal. They wanted to use Intel instead of AMD's Ryzen. It was actually a viewer's pal or a listener's pal. But Chip says, we have about 36 PCs that run 24/7 except for two, one of our HP Ryzen 5, one of our Dell Ryzen 5 units. All the Intel i5 and or i7s have no problems. 8 of the Ryzens have no problems. But those 20% of the Ryzens take up 80% of the fire hosing time. I realize small sample size, et cetera, but still I am hesitant to go Ryzen on our next purchases. So something to keep in mind. Yeah, I will say that
a lot of that is platform. It's platform.
Yeah.
I mean, as you and I have noticed this before, like I had a system I was using for streaming for this show, actually, that was AMD-based to start last year, and I had some intermittent issues with USB connectivity and stuff, and moving to Intel just solved it. But it could have been any number of things. It could be driver related. Sometimes people have issues with Intel NIC drivers on an AMD platform, for example. I think I had one machine where I had to disable them. It's just random stuff, and it could just be chipset or motherboard firmware related, but that kind of stuff seems to be less problematic on Intel. But to be snarky for a second, Intel hasn't really changed platforms in about 4 years. So it's a lot more mature over there in the Skylake world.
I don't know what to tell you. Something to think about if you're thinking about purchasing a machine. I've had no stability issues. I did have some USB video capture issues that related to video being softer or less saturated when captured over the USB ports on an AMD box, a Ryzen box versus a Intel machine or an Intel laptop. But in terms of actual stability, I've had pretty good luck with AMD. But Chips wants to remind you it's not always as stable as you want it to be. Speaking of stability, this show, we're here for you each and every week. If you haven't joined us before, we call it This Week in Computer Hardware. Twitch is what we call it for short. Twit.tv/Twitch is a place to find all of the information on the show, including links to just about any format you might want to subscribe on or any podcatcher. And if you have a podcatcher you'd like to use, just search for This Week in Computer Hardware, and I suspect you'll find us. We got video and audio versions, and we invite you to check out any of them that tickle your fancy. But if you haven't subscribed, please subscribe, because that's the best way to make sure you get each and every week of This Week in Computer Hardware in your inbox. The handsome gentleman in the big blue room, which apparently is purple if you're in the room, but not if you're in the color corrected version or the color.
Yeah, we'll have to fix it in post, Patrick, or any number of things, because it looks blue. You could just project, you know, some sort of a scene. I'm actually in Milan this week.
That makes
just
so
my traveling set
with your green screen.
I forgot.
He's the editor in chief of PCPer.com, and probably will be furiously running benchmarks right after he signs off from this show. PCPer.com is the website. You can find more of me at avxl.com. It's a podcast I host with Robert Herron, where we talk about, guess what, screens and audio, and we're just finishing up our post-CES, good Lord, what just happened, and was there interesting things there at all? Which there was, but we'll get into it on the next episode of AVXL. Hey, do us a favor, tune in next week, because we love having you here, and we love talking about hardware for you. Email us, twitch@twit.tv.com. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peake.
Catch you next week on Twitch.